Now to say, Jones believes such and such, and Jones believed such and such yesterday, is not to say the same thing in different words. Jones may have changed his mind between yesterday and today. Jones is a being with a history. Jones is subject to change. Jones has duration, is spread out in time. If we suppose that the ultimate designer is similarly spread out in time, we run into intolerable difficulties. If today he remembers that Napoleon died at St. Helena, but tomorrow forgets this, will the statement that Napoleon died at St. Helena, although true today, become false tomorrow? We are forced to conclude that the ultimate designer, whom I will hereafter call God for short, does not have duration. I remind you of Dr. Brandon's remark in this evening's lecture. Time is in the universe is not in time. Time and space are not some huge container into which all of reality, every material object, every mind, every entity must be fitted. They are the network of spatial and temporal relationships that exist among things in this world. A writer, in writing a novel, creates not only characters and events, but also their relationships to one another, spatial, temporal, causal, personal. But the framework of the novel, with all the pieces that that framework holds together, is in the mind of the author. The mind of the author is not in that framework. The writer, unlike God, does have duration, but not duration in the time series of the book. One does not ask, how old was Dagny Taggart when Ayn Rand first got the idea for Atlas Shrugged? I spoke a few minutes ago of two objections to the theist conclusion, and it is now time to consider the second, the existence of evil. In our present context, where God is being considered primarily as the ground of truth and of man's ability to grasp it, the problem is most immediately one of the existence of error. If God has designed our minds to enable us to learn the truth, why is it that our minds sometimes make mistakes? This question is particularly apposite when directed to those who suppose that if the world is dependent on God for its existence, then the world must in some sense be God, that God is simply another name for the universe itself, the sum total of reality looked at in a religious way. This view is called pantheism. Those who take it say that all my thoughts are really God's thoughts, an aspect of the divine mind, and that all my actions are really God's actions, an aspect of the divine activity. This puts them in the position of maintaining either that there is no such thing as a false thought or a wrong action, or else that the distinction between right and wrong, between true and false, is of no importance on the divine level. And that, I submit, is an adequate refutation of pantheism. A sound account of man's mind must account both for knowledge and for error. Atheism leaves no room for the possibility of knowledge. Pantheism leaves no room for the possibility of error. Only theism, the belief that we are created by God but distinct from God, accounts for both. But, it may be asked, how does theism account for error? Given that my mind and God's mind are not identical, if he designed my mind, oughtn't he to have done a better job of it? This is a special case of the objection, if God is both all good and all powerful, why is there evil in the world? Now, you will note that this objection can be raised only against someone who has asserted both the goodness and the omnipotence of God. I have mentioned God's goodness only parenthetically, and have made no attempt whatever to prove his omnipotence. This is not simply a tactical device on my part to deprive objectors of a convenient statement to pounce on. I do not at present see that the omnipotence of God can be proved from objectivist principles. As far as I can see, an objectivist is perfectly free to deny it, and still remain a good, sound, rational disciple of Miss Rand. It is necessary to suppose that God is sufficiently interested in us to care whether we think correctly or not, and that he has considerable influence over the forces that brought us about. Otherwise, our cognitive apparatus would not be a suitable instrument. But it is not necessary to suppose anything much stronger than that. What, you may ask? Does not his position as the being in whose mind everything is going on make him absolute master of the situation? Not necessarily. It makes everything absolutely dependent on him, in that if he did not exist, neither would anything else. But it does not follow that it is absolutely dependent on his will. My toothache is dependent on me, in that if I did not exist, then neither would my toothache. But it is not the case that if I did not want my toothache to exist, then it would not exist. In any case, we see that once we have established the existence of a being with some of the attributes of God, such as that the whole of reality exists only because he exists, and that he is omniscient and normative and timeless, the objections such as the problem of evil have weight only as objections to the thesis that he is omnipotent, not to the thesis that there is such a being at all. But more of this when we get to Dr. Brandon's comments on the problem of evil. In summary, then, to be an objectivist means to accept, among other things, the assertion that there is an external reality and that man's mind, man's reason, is an instrument adequate and appropriate to the investigation of that reality. But this assertion is meaningful only in the context of beliefs about the nature and origins of man's mind which are consistent with that assertion. The dropping of that context renders the affirmation of confidence in man's mind meaningless. In the first lecture of this series, Dr. Brandon spoke at length about the fallacy of the stolen concept, the attempt so frequently made by anti-rational philosophers to utilize a concept outside the rational framework which alone renders that concept tenable. Ladies and gentlemen, the atheist who, while remaining an atheist, undertakes to accept the fundamental principles of objectivism and to reason therefrom, provides us with a classic example, a textbook example, of the fallacy of the stolen concept. I promised at the beginning of Part 1 that, after presenting the positive case for theism on objectivist grounds, I would examine Dr. Brandon's arguments and state where, in my judgment, he goes astray. To this task I now turn. Dr. Brandon begins by contrasting faith with reason and complaining because theists rely on faith, whereas objectivists regard reason as the sole basis of belief. His complaint seems to be that people ask him to believe in God, and when he asks, "Why should I? On what grounds?" they answer, "Don't argue about it, don't ask questions, don't think, just believe." If it is a lack of argument that he is complaining about, then I have done my best to remedy the deficiency, and I am scarcely the first person to have done so. The fact that the average theist cannot argue the point very well does not prove that theism is irrational. The average college student cannot give cogent arguments for supposing that the earth moves, but Dr. Brandon would not call post-Ptolemaic astronomy irrational. Nevertheless, it must be granted that theists, most notably Christians, do talk about the importance of faith. Are they urging the importance of unreason? The word faith is used in several senses, and in replying to Dr. Brandon's charge, it is necessary to sort some of them out. First, faith is sometimes used to mean the faculty by which we grasp fundamental postulates or premises of reason, such as that A is A. Dr. Brandon, in an earlier lecture of this series, denounces as subversive of all rationality the doctrine that believing the postulates is an act of faith. But I believe that the problem is sometimes one of terminology. The problem is that the word reason is being used in two senses, rather as New York may mean either the borough, the city, or the state. Ratio, or reason, is used by Thomas Aquinas to refer either to the rational soul, or to all the activities proper to the rational soul, or to that particular activity which we may call deduction. In the following passage, he uses ratio in the narrow sense and distinguishes it from intellectus, or intellect. Quote, Summa Theologiae, Part 1, Question 79, Article 8. Intellect is the simple, that is, indivisible or uncompounded, grasp of an intelligible truth, whereas reasoning is the progression toward an intelligible truth by going from one understood point to another. The difference between them is thus like the difference between rest and motion or between possession and acquisition. Close quote. Dr. Samuel Johnson's dictionary similarly defines reason in the narrower sense, calling it, quote, the power by which man deduces one proposition from another or proceeds from premises to consequences, close quote. In most philosophic usage today, the word reason is restricted to its narrower sense, to mean logical deduction of conclusions from premises. Now, when it is so restricted, it is clear that we need another word to describe the process by which we come to accept the premises, or, if we cannot remember a time when we did not hold the premises, our grounds for confidence in them when challenged. To say that, although we arrive at the theorems in geometry by reasoning, we do not accept the postulates on the basis of reason, is simply to say that the postulates are not theorems, that premises are not conclusions, that the earliest statements in a proof are not preceded by still earlier statements. Aquinas would have expressed this by saying that we know the theorem of Pythagoras by reason, but grasp by intellect the truth that things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Modern writers do not use the term intellect here unless they are avowed disciples of Aquinas. They will say intuition, or instinct, or faith. Now, sometimes they do mean that accepting the postulates is not an intellectual matter at all, but quite often they mean simply that the postulates are not arrived at by reason in the narrow sense. Comes now Miss Rand, using reason in the broader sense to include what Aquinas called intellect. The result is that Miss Rand seems to be believing on the basis of reason what others believe on the basis of intuition, instinct, or faith. But before concluding that the difference between Miss Rand and her opponent on this point is substantive rather than terminological, we must find out, if we can, what her opponent means by intuition, or whatever term he uses. Sometimes her opponent will boldly declare that he accepts the postulates not because he has any rational grounds for doing so, but because he chooses to do so by a mere arbitrary act of will. Even here we must take care lest we misunderstand him. In mathematics, for example, we are almost always concerned with deducing conclusions from arbitrarily adopted premises. We say, let G be a finite abelian group subject to the restriction that, and go on from there. On a more elementary level, your second grade teacher used to say to you things like, Farmer Brown had 23 chickens and 8 of them died, how many were left alive? If you had asked her, where did you get that story about Farmer Brown, and how do you know that it's true? Her response would have been that she was making an arbitrary assumption and asking you to consider its consequences. If you had denounced the making of arbitrary assumptions as anti-rational, the atmosphere might have waxed unpleasant. Often, of course, the mathematician will be working from premises that he thinks true. But even when he cares whether Farmer Brown's chickens are really dead, he will not call looking at them a logical or mathematical activity. Even when someone says, my belief that A is an act of the will, an arbitrary choice on my part, he may mean, I choose to think, to be rational, to be sane, although the option of lunacy is open to me and to every other being of volitional consciousness. So much for faith in the first sense. Second, faith is sometimes used to mean the adherence to reason as against feeling. Let me give an example. I know of a certain physics teacher who once began a lecture by writing on the board in foot-high letters the words, Faith in Physics. The students had been studying elementary mechanics and all knew that a pendulum bob released from rest at a given height will not swing to a greater height, and could explain why this is so in terms of potential and kinetic energy, and so forth. Now he asked one student to explain this principle to the class, and the student did. Then the professor asked him, Do you believe all that stuff you just spouted about the pendulum? Are you sure it's true? The student answered, Yes, of course. The professor then unveiled the apparatus for the day, a large pendulum hanging from the ceiling with an axe head at the bottom. He stood the student up at one side of the room, pulled the axe up so that the blade just touched his chin, and released it. The blade swung across to the other side of the room and back again, just barely caressing the student's chin. There now, chuckled the professor, that's one physics lesson you won't forget in a hurry. You will perhaps agree that it would not have been surprising if the student had been a bit nervous, or even panicked and dodged as he saw the blade coming toward him. In such a situation, it is very easy to lose faith in physics. But it would not have been reason that took away his faith. The battle is between reason and faith on one side and emotion and imagination on the other. Now, if a man has come to believe in God, there will almost certainly be times when he is in a disbelieving mood. He may be feeling depressed or frustrated, and the world seems so squalid and meaningless that the arguments for belief in God seem abstract and irrelevant. Or he may feel a strong urge to do something that his religious code forbids, or otherwise find that it would be very convenient if his religious beliefs were not true, and so may be disposed to regard them as false, or more probably to avoid thinking about them. In this and similar contexts, Christians are accustomed to call the practice of being guided by intellect rather than emotion the virtue of faith. 3. Faith is sometimes used to mean gambling on a proposition. For most things, the evidence available to us is less than conclusive. Suppose you are ill and the doctor recommends an operation but says, "I cannot guarantee that it will improve your condition, it may even worsen it." In this context, you cannot know with certainty or anything approaching it whether you will be better off with the surgery or without it. But once you and the doctor have chosen a course of action, you must act as firmly and decisively as if you were absolutely sure that the choice was the correct one. And so with a good many ventures. You undertake the venture with less than certainty that it is sound, but, having undertaken it, proceed as if you knew it to be sound, since anything short of that will certainly be pointless. 4. Faith may be used to mean trust in a person, trust going, in a sense, beyond the evidence. Let us consider the situation of a young man who is heir to a vast fortune. He meets a number of young women and finds them very attractive and agreeable, but he is not sure whether they like him or merely want to get their hands on his money. He dislikes the idea of losing half his wealth after a 6-month marriage, and dislikes even more the idea of being had for a chump. No matter how affectionate and sincere a woman may seem, he can never be sure that she is not thinking in terms of alimony and the community property settlement. So he may resolve never to fall in love. On the other hand, he may say, "I know that I am taking a risk. To love is to be vulnerable. I cannot fall in love without the chance of being very badly hurt. But I am willing to take that chance. I prefer it to the alternative of a loveless existence." Not everyone will find that a reasonable choice. There are people whose greatest satisfaction is being able to say, "Nobody ever puts anything over on me. Nobody ever bluffs me out at poker. I call the hand every time. Nobody will ever con me, make me a sucker, induce me into an unmerited trust, play me for a fool." Such a man will die a bachelor and friendless. He will probably also have lost quite a bit at poker. But he has what he says he wants. Incidentally, if somewhere along the line our man, the one who is never conned, has gotten married, he will be a jealous husband. It is a matter of plain experience that, if you start looking for indications that your spouse might be up to something, you will almost certainly find them. And, once again, you can choose. When you find a couple of ticket stubs lying around, you can refuse to rest until you know exactly who used them. Your spouse, if reasonable, will probably explain in detail with corroborative evidence the first few times something looks fishy, but if your suspiciousness gets out of hand, may very well end up saying, "No, I will not tell you where I went for lunch today. Either we have a relationship of trust or we don't. If you trust me, then you don't need to know. If you don't, then nothing short of a full-time detective on my trail would satisfy you, and even then you would begin to suspect the detective of taking bribes. We can't afford a detective, and in any case, a marriage preserved on that basis is a marriage destroyed. So make up your mind whether you will trust me without proof, and then we will know where we stand." Unfortunately, that is precisely what a guilty spouse, if clever, would say. When you decide to trust someone, you risk betrayal. You can't have it both ways. A warrior or a mountaineer cannot be both very brave and very safe. If you are a Christian, you will be asked to put your trust in God. When, from time to time, it looks as if God is double-crossing you, you will be asked to do the equivalent of glancing at a couple of unexplained ticket stubs, tossing them into the waste paper basket, and forgetting them. whether you think that reasonable is in a way a matter of taste. Which do you dread more? Finding out that a friend whom you trusted has betrayed you, or finding out that a friend who you thought had betrayed you, and from whom you accordingly parted in anger years ago, was innocent after all? There is risk either way. 5. A fifth use of the word faith is in the phrase justification by faith, used by Dr. Martin Luther and others. Here what is meant is, very roughly, recognizing and facing up to the fact that you can never put God in the position of owing you a favor. Any further discussion of this doctrine is likely to get technical, and I hereby beg off. This reminds me of something I should have said much earlier. When I speak of being a theist, I mean accepting the proposition that the ultimate designer, as heretofore described, exists. This leaves the question, shall I become A. a Jew, B. a Christian, C. a Muslim, D. none of the above, still very much open. And I am not trying to answer it, at least not tonight. I have brought up the subject of Christianity because of Dr. Brandon's references to the distressing intellectual habits of theists. This has to be dealt with in terms of examples, and the Christian examples are the ones I know best. In case anyone is curious, I am myself a Christian, an Orthodox, tradition-minded, High Church Episcopalian, and capable on occasion of being downright stuffy about it. Dr. Brandon's opening attack on the concept of God is worth examining in some detail. He speaks as follows, quote, God, claim the mystics, is infinite. What does it mean to be infinite? It means to possess no limits, to possess no specific, determinate, finite number of attributes, no specific, particular, identifiable qualities. It means to be nothing in particular. But to be nothing in particular is not to be. Close quote. I maintain that atheism is essentially a foreign intrusion into objectivist thought, and that therefore, when Dr. Brandon is defending atheism, he does not do so with his usual lucidity. By way of illustration, I ask you to consider what would result if he were to apply to objectivism the same sort of criticism that he is prepared to use against theism. Let us construct an imaginary quotation for him. Imaginary quote. Ladies and gentlemen, let us consider the first principle of objectivism, that existence exists. Existence, also called reality or the universe, is the sum of all existing entities, the total of all that is. This means of all material entities. Non-material means non-anything you know. Since a combination of material entities is itself a material entity, we see that the universe is a material object. Now the first questions one asks about a material object are, what shape is it? How big is it? Where is it? Now the universe has no shape. To have a shape, it must have boundaries, a surface, but the universe does not. The universe has no size. To call it infinitely large is not to specify a size, but simply to call it larger than any size we know or can conceive. To call it finite but unbounded, limited but unlimited, as some physicists do, is no help, even assuming that it can be made to mean something. The one length a yardstick cannot measure is its own length. You cannot specify the size of an object in terms of itself or any part of itself. It is not informative to be told that the length of a piece of string is twice the distance from the center to one end. The only way to measure the universe is to set a yardstick beside it that is not part of the universe. But there is no such yardstick. Finally, and most crucially, the universe has no location. It makes no sense to ask, where is the universe? If someone were to say, last night the entire universe was moved sideways 10 miles, a natural response would be to look puzzled and ask, 10 miles toward what? To specify the location of anything is to describe its spatial relations to adjacent objects. But there are no objects adjacent to the universe. Space is in the universe. The universe is not in space. We are asked, then, to consider a material object having no shape in particular, no size in particular, and existing nowhere in particular, not in space. But for a material object, to be nowhere in particular, to be not in space, is not to be. We thus see that the fundamental principle of objectivism, that existence exists, is utterly false, unintelligible, and an insult to man's reason. Close imaginary quote. The application of Dr. Brandon's atheological style to an objectivist topic furnishes a striking example of the principle that the objectivist who sets out to deny theism ends up denying objectivism in the process. Next, Dr. Brandon attacks the assertion that God is pure spirit. In this context, he says, spirit means non-matter, that is, non-anything you know. I think we can improve on that a little. Some acts are physical, such as moving from place to place. Other acts are mental, such as believing, fearing, remembering, choosing, and the like. The distinction is clear to most persons, and Dr. Brandon devotes most of the first chapter of Self-Esteem to hammering it home. Now, given the distinction between mental and physical acts, and the dictum that action presupposes an entity that acts, we may agree to call an entity that performs physical acts a physical entity, or body, and an entity that performs mental acts a mental entity, or mind. We then have a choice between saying that some bodies are closely connected with minds, and saying that some bodies are minds, that is, that some entities perform both mental and physical acts. Dr. Brandon, in company with Aristotle and some but not all theists, chooses the latter. He goes on to say that every entity, whether it is a mind or not, must be a body, since we have no experience of any mind that is not identical with or connected with a body. To speak of a bodiless mind is thus to be guilty of context dropping. But, as Dr. Brandon points out in the chapter just cited, I have no experience of a mind not identical with, or connected with, my own body. To speak of the consciousness of another human is also to remove consciousness from the only context in which I have encountered it. Dr. Brandon says that a bodiless mind means an entity aware without any means of awareness, which is absurd. Let us assume, for the sake of argument, that it is impossible for a mind to be directly aware of a physical situation, that it needs some means of awareness. What follows? In what sense are the sense organs a means of awareness? How is Jones aware that the grass is green? Green light from the grass enters his eye and strikes his retina, which then reacts in a certain way. But how does Jones know what is happening to his retina? Electrical impulses travel along the optic nerve from the retina to the brain. But how does Jones know what is happening in his brain? Somewhere along the line, a physical event, such as a neuron firing, must produce a mental event, such as Jones's awareness that the grass is green. If Dr. Brandon has a theory of perception that does not, at some point, involve a physical cause of a mental event, I should like to hear it. But if physical things can and do cause mental events directly, then it is not clear why there cannot be a mind whose awareness that the earth is round is caused directly by the physical fact of the earth's being round. Dr. Brandon says, God is said to be omnipotent. This means that, 1, God has no nature, 2, things in general have no nature, and 3, contradictions are possible. As for the first assertion that God has no nature, I think that Dr. Brandon has confused can with might. To say that God can do anything is not to say that he might do anything. If we ask, can Miss Rand break a display window at Tiffany's with a baseball bat, and might she, the distinction is tolerably clear. To say that someone cannot do something is to say that there is a cause other than his will preventing him. To say that God can do anything is to say that there are no external obstacles to the execution of his will, not that his will does not follow from the kind of being he is, just as Miss Rand's not breaking windows follows from the kind of being that she is. Dr. Brandon says, if God is omnipotent, then nothing has any nature. I think this is hasty. We say, in Dr. Brandon's terms, that when we use a stone for a paperweight, we know that it will stay where we put it and not go making figure eights in the air, because that would not be in accordance with its nature. But if someone comes by and picks up the stone and starts waving it around in the figure 8 pattern, the nature of the stone has not been altered. True enough, Dr. Brandon might say, but if God might at any moment start picking up paperweights and moving them in figure 8 patterns, then we live in an irrational and chaotic world. Again, I think that's hasty. I remind you of the parallel between God as creator of the world and a writer as creator of the events in a novel. As regards the contents of Atlas Shrugged, Miss Rand is omnipotent. She can make Hank Reardon and his wife fall madly in love with each other. She can make James Taggart, in the last chapter, throw off his pose of incompetence and come up with a new invention, better than Reardon metal or the Galt motor, that will save the world. She can make Dagny Taggart become a fanatical disciple of the Guru Maharaji. All of the characters, all of the events, are utterly at her mercy. Does this mean that the novel must be without plot, without structure, without rationality, that none of the persons in it may be said to have a nature? Does it not rather mean that when we perceive the orderliness and rationality of the novel, we are in touch with the rationality of Miss Rand's creative imagination? Very well. When we perceive the rationality of the world, we are in touch with the rationality of God. Dr. Brandon says, if God is omnipotent, contradictions are possible. Now, clearly, if we define omnipotence as the power or ability to do anything, including the contradictory, it follows that the idea of an omnipotent being leads to contradictions. Since I do not believe in contradictions, I do not believe that God is omnipotent in that sense. When I say that God is omnipotent, I mean that for any situation S, God can bring about S if and only if there is no contradiction involved in God's bringing about S. As far as I can see, this definition of omnipotence does not lead to contradictions. Dr. Brandon may complain, but my definition of omnipotence is the correct one, and there is no possibility of discussion if you give words perverse and incorrect definitions. I ask, in what sense Dr. Brandon's definition is the correct one? Is it for etymological reasons, because omnis means every and potens means powerful? But many Latinists would argue that omnipotence originally meant having power over all things, or even rightful authority over all things. Besides, the etymological argument is a treacherous tool. Electrical devices are not really made of amber. Objectivism is not really the philosophy of throwing rocks, a la Abby Hoffman. And not even a scholarly bus driver will let you ride without paying your fare, just because you remind him that bus is short for omnibus, which means for everyone. Does omnipotence imply the power to do everything because that is the definition that the man in the street would give? Beware that argument unless you are prepared to accept the popular definition of anarchy, of selfishness, of morality, and the like. The relevant question here is surely how theologians use the word omnipotent and whether they have been accustomed to use it in Dr. Brandon's sense until he came along to point out the difficulties, whereupon they are now sneakily intending to change definitions and keep the game going. A bit of history is here indicated. In the New Testament, 2 Timothy 2:13, we read, God cannot contradict himself. Aristotle, Metaphysics, Becker, page 1019, distinguishes relative and absolute impossibility, the former that which cannot be done by a given agent because of the limitations of that agent, the latter that which cannot be done at all. Aquinas, Summa Theologiae, Part 1, Question 75, Articles 3 and 4, refers to this passage and identifies the absolutely impossible with the contradictory. He defines omnipotence as the ability to do everything that is absolutely possible, i.e., non-contradictory. He comments on the text, with God no thing shall be impossible, Luke 1:37, by saying, a contradiction in terms cannot be a thing, for no mind can conceive it. Elsewhere, Part 1, Question 7, Article 3, he gives the creating of a thing with the property of not having been created as an example of something God cannot do. A century before Aquinas, St. Anselm wrote his Proslogium, chapter 7 of which is headed, How He, God, is omnipotent, although there are many things of which he is not capable. The point about contradiction is often worded in terms of altering the past. Aristotle, Ethics, Becker, page 1139, approvingly quotes the past, quotes the poet Agathon as saying, quote, for this alone is lacking e'en to God, to make undone the things that once are done. Eight centuries before Aquinas, St. Augustine wrote, against Faustus 25:5, quote, "Whoever says, 'If God is almighty, let him make what is done to be not done,' does not realize that he is saying, 'If God is almighty, let him make true things to be both true and false.'" Close quote. St. Jerome wrote, Epistle 24, "Though God can do everything, he cannot make the unspoilt from the spoilt." This is glossed as, "God cannot turn a harlot into a virgin, since the definition of a virgin includes her past history, and a virgin who has been a harlot is a contradiction." Jewish theologians also concur. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, Guide for the Perplexed, Chapter 75, Argument 1, says, quote, "An agent is not deficient in power if it is unable to perform what is intrinsically impossible. Thus, we monotheists do not consider it a defect in God that he has not combined two opposites in one object, nor do we test his omnipotence by the accomplishment of any similar impossibility." Close quote. I regret that my limited knowledge does not permit me to produce suitable quotations from Muslim sources. In summary, then, it is Dr. Brandon who has given to the word omnipotence a private meaning of his own, and when he points out that God cannot be omnipotent in his special sense, theists from all centuries reply in chorus, "We never thought him omnipotent in your sense. What else is new?" And what of the Bible verse that says, "With God all things are possible"? The commentary you will get on that verse depends on the theologian you approach. One answer might be, "All sentences beginning 'God can' are true, but a string of nonsense syllables does not suddenly become a sentence just because it is preceded by the two magic words, 'God can.' God can do anything, but that is not the same thing as saying that he can both do it and not do it simultaneously. Contradictions are excluded, not because there are any limits to God's power, but because nonsense remains nonsense even when we talk about God. You ask whether God can make a round square. God can make any shape at all, but round square is not the name of a shape. You ask whether God can make a rock so heavy that he can't lift it. Now, for any human, there exists a number y such that x cannot lift a rock whose weight is y pounds or more, and God can make a rock weighing y pounds. But, for x equals God, there exists no such number y, and therefore you have not specified a weight, and therefore have not asked a genuine question. Ask a genuine, meaningful, well-formed question of the form, 'Can God do such and such?' and the answer will always be yes." Dr. Brandon says that if God is omniscient, then everything must be fated and predetermined, in which case it cannot be changed, in which case God is not omnipotent. I reply that divine omniscience, far from being incompatible with divine freedom, does not even impair human freedom. I offer three replies to Dr. Brandon, each in itself sufficient. The first is found in Boetius in the Consolations of Philosophy, and is simply that, as we saw in the first part of this lecture, God is not in time. Spatial and temporal distances are part of the internal structure of the interlocking physical system which we call the cosmos, and do not relate the cosmos to God, who is the creator of the cosmos and its structure. Thus, it is not strictly true that God knows today what will happen tomorrow. God's knowledge is not a temporal event. Alternately, we may note that Dr. Brandon's argument that divine omniscience implies fatalism has no real connection with divine omniscience, and can be stated just as well without it. Dr. Brandon says, in effect, "God knows whether Jones will steal tomorrow. If God knows that Jones will steal, then Jones must steal, and if God knows that Jones will not steal, then Jones cannot steal. Either way, Jones is not free." But Dr. Brandon could equally well have said, "It is either true or false that Jones will steal tomorrow. If it is true, then Jones must steal. If it is false, then Jones cannot steal. Either way, Jones is not free." If the omniscience of God is incompatible with freedom, then so is the law of the excluded middle. A soldier goes into battle saying, "No use worrying, either there is a bullet there with my name on it, or there isn't." And he is quite right. Every bullet either does or does not have the property of being a bullet that is going to kill that soldier. Thus his fate is determined, right? If this argument is sound, then Dr. Brandon must abandon his belief in free will. If it is not sound, then the bullet can have the property now of being a future killer without making that future killing inevitable. And if so, then how does God's knowing as regards each bullet whether it has that property alter matters? One way out is to deny that each bullet does already either have or not have the property of being about to kill that soldier. We may say, at the present moment, the bullet is a potential killer and a potential non-killer, but neither an about-to-be-killer nor an about-to-be-non-killer. The statement that it will kill is not yet either true or false. Aristotle, on Interpretation, Becker, page 18, considers this argument, concludes that A or not A, the law of the excluded middle, is indeed incompatible with human freedom, and that, since freedom is a reality, the law must be inapplicable to future human action. He says, quote, "In the case of that which is or which has taken place, propositions must be either true or false. When, however, the subject is individual and that which is predicated of it relates to the future, the case is altered. For if all propositions are either true or false, then there would be no need to deliberate or to take trouble on the supposition that, if we should adopt a certain course, a certain event would follow, while, if we did not, the result would not follow. For a man may predict an event 10,000 years beforehand, and another predict the reverse. That which was truly predicated will of necessity take place in the fullness of time. Further, it makes no difference whether people have or have not actually made the contradictory statements, for events will not take place or fail to take place because it was stated that they would or would not take place. Yet this view leads to an impossible conclusion, for we see that both deliberation and action are causative with regard to the future, and that there is a potentiality in either direction. Since propositions correspond with facts, it is evident that when in future events there is a real alternative, and a potentiality in contrary directions, the corresponding affirmation and denial have the same character. It is therefore plain that it is not necessary that of an affirmation and a denial, one should be true and the other false. For in the case of that which exists potentially but not actually, the rule which applies to that which exists actually does not hold good." Close quote. Aristotle's solution, if we accept it, permits us to say that God is omniscient, but does not know whether Jones will steal tomorrow, because the statement that Jones will steal tomorrow is in fact neither true nor false, but indeterminate, so that even an omniscient being, especially an omniscient being, when asked about the proposition that Jones will steal tomorrow, would have to answer not true or false, but indeterminate. This is not an admission of ignorance, but the correct answer, the only correct answer. It is like the situation in quantum physics, where, according to most physicists, a particle does not have an exact position, and the inexactness is not merely in our knowledge of the position, but in the position itself. Now, if this be so, it is clear that not even an omniscient being can be expected to know the exact position of a particle that does not have an exact position. It is like saying that God must know the address of my stockbroker even though I don't have a stockbroker. A third way of answering Dr. Brandon is by calling attention to the ambiguity in statements of the form, if A, then necessarily B. We say, for example, if Jones is younger than Smith, then Jones must be younger than Smith's mother. And it is easy to read this as meaning that if the first clause is true, then the second clause expresses a necessary truth, an inescapable truth, the truth guaranteed by logic. But of course in such sentences, logic does not guarantee B, but only the derivation of B from A. The adverb necessarily modifies not B, but if A then B. B is not a necessary truth, but a necessary consequence of A. Instead of saying, given A, B must hold, we ought to say, given A, B must follow.